travel, ER, prescription drugs, self-referral to more expensive specialists.
Republicans introduce a bill to control Medicaid costs. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the joy of finding yourself in better race shape than you expected.
I was just taking care of my dogs and tending to things and came in here in third place and I was like, wow, what in the world? I figured I'd be in 20th.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, human resources, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
A Medicaid reform bill has been filed in the Alaska Senate. Many Republican legislators have said reform of the state's low-income health care program must happen before they accept federal dollars to expand it. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez joins us to talk about what's in the bill and what it means for the program's future. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
Alexandra, talk of a Medicaid reform bill coming out of the Senate picked up earlier this month. Today, Senator Pete Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, finally introduced it. What are his goals with the bill?
At a meeting with reporters this afternoon, Kelly said his objective was to rein in waste with the state's Medicaid program. He sees unnecessary spending happening in four areas.
Travel, ER, prescription drugs, self-referral to more expensive specialists.
The bill he introduced today addresses those areas generally. There's a section on emergency services, setting up a program tracking frequent ER visits, and there's also language that sets up a prescription monitoring program and requires guidelines for prescribing narcotics to Medicaid patients. But Kelly's goal is adamantly not to expand Medicaid.
Right now, the state's Medicaid program mostly covers low-income children and pregnant women. With expansion, adults who make up to 138% of the poverty level could get government health care. That's about $20,000 a year for a single person. What does this bill do for people who don't receive Medicaid now, but would through expansion?
So this bill really does not apply to them. There's a section that sets up a managed care pilot program of sorts, but it only applies to those already enrolled in state Medicaid. There's also a section establishing a health savings account by taking 10% of a recipient's permanent fund dividend that's voluntary, but again, that only applies to people who are eligible for state Medicaid now. But as the bill goes through the committee process, there are changes that could be made that could affect the population that would be covered by expanded Medicaid. The legislation right now is just 7 pages, and it's written in pretty broad strokes. Healthcare policy is complicated and wonky, and by comparison, the Affordable Care Act was more than 1,000 pages. So if the legislature is really going to get into reform, it's possible the bill could grow.
So, Alexandra, what does this bill mean for Medicaid expansion, if anything?
It's hard to say. While the bill does not currently expand Medicaid, legislators could add expansion language in if they so choose as the bill goes through the committee process. For passage, the bill would have to go through the Senate and then go over to the House for review. It's expected to be referred to the House Health and Social Services Committee, which is chaired by a Homer Republican who's been open to the idea of Medicaid expansion. It would also likely go to the House Finance Committee, where there are a few members who have also been friendly to the idea. But even if language does get added to this bill, it would still have to go back to the Senate for approval and potentially for a conference committee. Kelly is not optimistic about that going over well in his body.
If I were to look into a crystal ball, I would say that would die in the Senate.
For their part, officials at the Department of Health and Social Services who have been pushing for expansion say they have not had time to review the bill.
It's day 53 of the legislative session. We're more than halfway done with the session. Can all this happen in time for adjournment?
If it does, it would have to be on a tight schedule, and it's a pretty complicated subject to jump into so late in the game. But then again, and some people might kill me for saying this, there's always the option of a special session.
Yes, there is. Thank you, Alexandra, for that update.
Thank you, Lori.
That was APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reporting from Juneau. The Alaska House of Representatives passed a $4 billion operating budget today, reducing agency operations by 10% over last year. The vote happened shortly after midnight. House Finance Co-Chair Mark Newman said a $230 million cut in unrestricted general fund spending set a record.
According to Legislative Finance, that reduction represents both the largest single-year dollar reduction and percentage cut in Alaska's history.
Every state agency saw its non-formula funding reduced compared to the previous budget. The Departments of Commerce, Education, and Military and Veterans Affairs took the greatest hits, with funding cut by roughly a third each. But while the cuts are significant, they're only a fraction of the $4 billion budget deficit that triggered them. One member of the Republican majority broke caucus rules and voted against the budget for that reason. Representative Laura Reinbold, who represents Eagle River, said she wanted bigger reductions.
I will be pushing the red button tonight, knowing that there may be unnecessary consequences by bucking the system, by challenging a very difficult system to work within. I encourage you to join me and do best for What's Alaska's Future by voting no on this unsustainable budget only until we make more meaningful reductions that reflect Alaska's current fiscal crises.
According to a spokesperson for the Republican majority, the caucus plans to meet to discuss Reinbold's actions. If she's kicked out of the caucus, she risks losing staff, committee leadership positions, and committee assignments. The Democratic minority also opposed the budget, but because it did not reflect their priorities. Through the night, Democrats offered 21 amendments to restore funding for early education, for workforce development, and for health care. None of their amendments succeeded. The operating budget will now be considered by the Senate, which says it plans further reductions. The Alaska Board of Game has turned down an emergency petition to reestablish a buffer zone to protect Denali National Park area wolves. Meeting today in Anchorage, the board voted unanimously to reject the petition from the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, the National Parks Conservation Association, Denali Citizens Council, and several individuals to create a no-kill zone on state lands along the northeastern edge of the park near Healy. The park wolf population has declined by two-thirds since the game board eliminated a previous buffer in 2010, but harvest has been relatively low, and board member Stosh Hoffman of Bethel pointed to natural factors like low prey numbers, likely also involved in the Denali wolves' decline.
The department has pointed out there is no conservation concern, and I agree with that. You know, wolf populations fluctuate like all other populations, and I don't see an emergency concern at this point.
Some board members who were not on the board when the original Denali wolf buffer was scrapped expressed regret that it was ever eliminated, but agreed that the current situation is not an emergency. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a 102-year-old Alaskan is honored for rural service.
I had a 30-foot round-bottom riverboat that I commuted to Aniak with in the summer. In the winter, I used my dog team.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A worker was killed at the Port of Anchorage earlier today while handling military equipment. Lindsay Witt is the head of external affairs for the port and says this morning's incident involved cargo shipping to the 1st Stryker Brigade in Fairbanks.
a longshoreman was working on the port, and he was loading military equipment onto the rail, and he was pinned between two pieces of military equipment.
The name of the man is being withheld until next of kin have been notified. Members of the Longshoremen's Union work under a company named SeaStar, unloading freight from the military's contractor in Alaska, Tote. Witt says the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, is investigating whether safety protocols broke down. But because the incident involves a private company, federal property, and a municipal facility, the specifics of the investigation aren't yet clear. Three village public safety officers have been selected to advance in the VPSO arming pilot project with training this month in Sitka. 21 VPSOs initially showed interest. Veteran VPSO First Sergeant James Holscher of Hooper Bay is the only VPSO set to be armed in the Yukon-Kuskokwim region. Also advancing are Sergeant Philip Plessinger of Fairbanks and NOATAC's Corporal Michael Gagliano. Lieutenant Andrew Merrill with the Alaska State Troopers says there are many reasons why the 18 other VPSOs did not continue in the program.
So we had the physical fitness test, which was a new process for a lot of VPSOs. So they physically couldn't pass that test. They have the opportunity to pass that test and participate in the future. Other VPSOs that were wholly capable physically and thought they could use force went through and thought about the fact they lived in a community where they were related to the majority of the community, the cousins, aunts, uncles, and the thought of using deadly force against one of their family members had them choose not to participate.
Participants also had to undergo an extensive psychological exam. Last year, the legislature passed a law allowing VPSOs to carry guns in addition to a taser and baton. It was spurred by the death of a VPSO in Manicotic, Thomas Madole, who was shot and killed while unarmed. In addition to the firearms training, the three VPSOs will receive instruction on defensive tactics, police communication, and use of force. They're expected to graduate from the program in April and could be armed soon after. Alaska's Attorney General has named the Fairbanks District Attorney as Bethel's new District Attorney. J. Michael Gray will begin in Bethel April 1st and will replace June Stein, who was fired last month. The state says Gray has 20 years of experience as a prosecutor in Alaska, beginning in Kodiak. He was named District Attorney there and later moved to head up the DA's office in Fairbanks. Several top Iditarod mushers are currently resting in Hooslia. Aaron Burmeister was the first to reach the checkpoint at around 10 p.m. last night. He was followed by Dallas Seavey, rookie Thomas Warner, and Ken Anderson. Race leaders won't start to shake out until after teams complete their mandatory 24 and 8-hour layovers and make up their start time differentials. But as Emily Schwing reports from Galena, many mushers are still surprised at where they're finding themselves in the standings.
When he arrived in Ruby, Aaron Burmeister had no idea he was near the front of the pack.
And no checkpoints we've been in, have we had any idea where we are. There's been no data, no information available. So I was just taking care of my dogs and tending to things and came in here in third place. And I was like, wow, what in the world? I figured I'd be in 20th.
Burmeister isn't the only musher who's been surprised about where his team is in the standings.
I am very surprised where I'm at, definitely.
That's Wade Mars. The 24-year-old has finished three Iditarods.
I thought I'd have a lot more catching up to do if I wanted to get in the top 10. Well, right now we just kind of got to keep doing what we're doing and keep things together, and we should be able to pull it off.
For Paige Drobny, it came as a surprise that she arrived in Galena in 24th place. She says she's had more rest this year in comparison to her previous two races.
I mean, the last 2 years when I came into, like, Nikolai, I felt like I had been pretty on top of things and, like, you know, like, running and resting quickly. And I was in, like, 40th place. And I was like, I couldn't believe that there was that many people doing it faster than what I was doing.
This year, no one's running a traditional race plan because they aren't traveling a traditional trail. So even for seasoned veterans like 14-time finisher Ken Anderson, it's not entirely clear how their teams are performing.
I've run the Iditarod so many times, you just know, okay, the dogs are going to look like this at this checkpoint. And you're just ready for it.
A third of the way into the race, Anderson wanted his dogs to look the way he'd expect them to if they were in Takotna, had he been running the normal southern route.
Come to think of it, they actually look better, yeah. Way better. Yeah, I just realized that.
Standings will remain something of a mystery until mushers complete both their mandatory 8 and 24-hour layovers and make up their time differential from the start. A trail report from race officials warns mushers of a long, cold slog along the rerouted trail to Hooslea and beyond to Koyukuk. Perhaps mushers may find a little bliss running in sub-zero temperatures if they remain somewhat ignorant about the new trail and where they're running amid the pack. On the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in Galena.
The annual spring ritual of honoring women who have helped shape Alaska took place last weekend in Anchorage. The Alaska Women's Hall of Fame holds their induction ceremony in the Wilda Marston Theater at the Lusac Library. Every year, women, some well-known and others not, are honored for their contributions to the state. This year's 13 inductees ranged from one of the first female USGS geologists, who at one point worked on a top-secret federal program, to women who had achievements in musical artistry and activism, and others who championed conservation and science education. Ann Stevens was honored posthumously for her work assisting her husband, the late Senator Ted Stevens, and serving on the board of the Red Cross, the Salvation Army, and other organizations. Her oldest son, Walter, said his mother had a great sense of humor, but also taught him important lessons about respect, particularly in the 1970s when Richard Nixon was president and the Stevens family had been invited to the White House for Sunday services.
I just kind of put my foot down and said, you know, no, I'm not going to see old Tricky Dick. And my mother came down the hallway very extremely agitated and said, you will go. I said, you might not like the person, but you will respect the office. So get your suit on and go. And so I did. There wasn't much choice. And I learned to, you know, that was a great lesson in respecting the higher institutions of this country, which I think, you know, we all should, regardless of who we might disagree with at the time that might be occupying those positions.
Inductee Arlene Buddy Clay came to Alaska in 1944, long before statehood. She and her husband worked for the Civil Aeronautics Administration. She says their first station was in Nome, and then they were transferred to Aniak. There, she became a magistrate. The Clays built a cabin near the village and lived a subsistence life together, traveling around the country with their dog team for a decade. When her husband died, she stayed on.
I had a 30-foot round-bottom riverboat with a 40-horse Johnson that I commuted to Aniak with in the summer. In the winter, I used my dog team. And I became magistrate in 1960 for the Alaska court system. And I had 12 villages under my jurisdiction, Kuskokwim, Yukon, and Iditarod Rivers.
Clay was inducted for her work in rural justice. She now lives in an assisted living home in Wasilla, and at age 102, she still operates her ham radio every Thursday evening, something she started in 1948. In all, 13 women were honored. It is the seventh year of inductions.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University offers working professionals courses designed to fit their busy lifestyles. With hybrid online and in-person classes, the MBA at APU is an accelerated, affordable, and high-quality pathway to career advancement. Learn more by calling 800-252-7528 or visiting alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, blogging. There are a bazillion blogs these days, but what does it take to write one people will actually read? Juno writer Libby Bacalar has figured out the formula with her blog One Hot Mess. Bacalar mixes it up when she writes, using humor, self-depreciation, social media, and even a Stephen Colbert-like character to connect with her audience. Her most read post, titled Alaska Airlines to English Dictionary, received more than 8,000 hits, and the blog is getting national attention, too. Boston's Women in Comedy Festival has asked Bacalar to submit to their blog. KTOO's Scott Burton has more.
6:15 on a school day morning, roll my ass out of bed and I yell out a warning. Get up, you two. You know I ain't playing. I'm about to crack skulls with all your mad disobeying.
This is Libby Bacalar, the writer of One Hot Mess, reciting her blog entry, Who to Boss. Bacalar is the mother of a 4- and 7-year-old who are often the subjects of her entries, which range from rap to essays to comics to flow and pie charts, resumes, haikus, and more.
Who the boss? That's me. You better hear this stanza. I'll be bossing you around like I was Tony Danza. Let's go my outlook.
The funnest part for me about the blog is having a shared experience with the audience about experiences they can all relate to, like getting your kid geared up for the rain or the snow.
Or not knowing certain etiquette, as in this selection from If I Actually Said What I Was Thinking at a Wine Tasting.
Wine pouring dude, perhaps you'd like to try this very mellow Shiraz? It's quite harmonious, complex, and evolved, with high tannins and an edgy bitterness that, me, yeah, no thanks, I'm good. Can you just pour me a giant glass of cold white sour grape juice now? And can you fill that sucker up all the way to the top? Like not just 2 or 3 inches of mouthwash at the bottom. Keep going.
She says she tries to be revelatory and analytical.
I try to get to the root of pretensions and phoniness and all kinds of insecurities and things like that that people, I think, appreciate honesty about. This whole wine tasting routine kind of has all of those elements. It's sort of this first world kind of pretentious thing that deserves to be made fun of a little bit. And I'm going to make fun of myself and it at the same time.
But she's not always rapping, humorous, or irreverent. About once a month, she writes an earnest piece, too, like in a November post, about how cathartic crying can be.
One of the things I hear a lot about the blog is, you're always saying what I'm really thinking, or you're always saying what I'm afraid to say. And that is the highest compliment I can get, because it means that I'm writing something that's resonating with people on a real level.
Sometimes Bacalar posts as many as 5 entries a day, most composed on her smartphone. She says she's inspired by her husband and comic writer Jeff Kirsch, David Sedaris, Louis C.K., Margaret Cho, and Stephen Colbert.
There's a little bit of a fourth wall, sort of Stephen Colbert-esque character developing. I'm not trying to compare myself to someone as awesome as Stephen Colbert, mind you. I'm just saying he's another person that I really admire in terms of his ability to straddle that meta line between reality and fiction.
That version of herself recently wrote a flirtatious open letter to a guy who works at a Juneau postal store. As usual, Bacalar linked to her entry on Facebook and, in a Juneau way, it's gone viral. She likes the interactivity.
It was all very true, everything I said in there about, you know, how I thought this guy was cute and I feel like an old lady every time I go in the store and blah, blah, blah. And he's listening to all this great music and et cetera, et cetera. But I wanted him to know all that and I was good with that. And then at the same time, I was curious, is all of this going to, you know, get back to him and his friends?
Hello, my name is Connor Lindrum, also known as Cute Dude at the Post Office Store, also known as CDAT POS.
One Hot Mess posted open letter to Cute Dude at the Post Office Store on Monday afternoon. Someone responded with his name within an hour, and he got the link soon thereafter. It took a little investigating, but he figured out who it was.
I was like, oh, it's that fox who I made eyes at, like, that day.
See, that post says it's all surreal. He wanted to meet her in person.
How much of this internet personality is her true personality? And how much of it is a construction for, like, you know, this art that she works on? Because, like, she's a very good writer. Like, she has a wonderful self-deprecating style and, like, very casual but precise. And, like, I really enjoy it.
After a bunch of Facebook correspondence, CDAT posts made Bacalar and her family dinner. Bacalar told the story of the dinner in 14 pictures on her blog. She declared the meal of marinated pork tenderloin with handmade garlic pesto, quote, top chef material, peeps, end quote, and gave the meal a 12 on a scale of 1 to 10. In Juneau, I'm Scott Burton.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we'll hear from a high school student from the Western Alaska village of Scammon Bay.
Hello, my name is
Ham James Gogtimagnak from Skemen Bay at the Lower Yukon School District. Going to school there is awesome because there's only like 100 people in middle school and high school combined. So it's quite small. That means you get to know people more and make more friends. We, after a 15-minute class hour, we go on a 3-minute break. That's when we just talk around in the hallways and try not to get scolded by teachers. I go home, try to do some homework if I have any, which is a low chance. And then I do a little bit of chores, because my mom get mad. Then I go on to play games, video games. Skamon Bay is way colder than Anchorage, but then you get to be closer to nature. Sometimes, if we have enough money, we Skamon Bayers and other rural villages go hunting or just an experience in nature. We also pick berries, hunt animals, go boat riding, fishing, which is just right outside our village. Being an Alaskan is truly a great experience. You get to be very close to Mother Nature, which means that you can meet animals in their natural habitat without going to a zoo. You can also feel the open air and not smogged.
Tom James Greg Tomaganuk is from Skamon Bay. He was in Anchorage recently for the academic decathlon. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Scott Burton, Ann Hillman, and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Ben Matheson and Dacia Eaton in Bethel, and Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, human resources, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.